I've got a strange feeling. Wow! I never felt like this before.
Jimi Hendrix, Eric Clapton, and Stevie Ray Vaughan have become famous for turning blues scales into something magical on their Fender Stratocasters. They all say that they were inspired to do it by my next guest, Buddy Guy. Rolling Stone has ranked him number 13 on its list of the top 100 guitarists of all time, odd since some of the people ahead of him were strongly influenced by him. Buddy Guy has appeared on over 70 records and is considered by many to be not just an innovator, but truly a living legend. He was here in June to talk about his memoir, When I Left Home, My Story, which he'd written with the help of David Ritz. In it, he described his childhood on a farm in Louisiana, how he came up in the Chicago blues scene with Muddy Waters and others, and the evolution of his music since. It was great to talk to this amazing musician, and we are replaying our conversation for you this Christmas Eve. I began by noting that Buddy Guy had grown up working in the cotton fields on a farm in Letsworth, Louisiana. And I asked him, did your parents own the farm?
No.
You say you were able to pick close, so they were sharecropping?
Yes, yeah. And eat to live and live to eat.
So it was really subsistence.
Yes.
And you say that you were able to pick 70 pounds of cotton a day. How old were you?
I started at 6. Someone just asked me that. Do you start at 12 years? No, on that farm, you was there. You had to start helping out at 6 years old because we didn't have machinery or nothing like that. You know, you start, they teach you how to pull the cotton out at 6 years old. If you didn't pull but 2-3 fingers full, at least you was on your way like preschool, you know.
And cotton isn't as easy to pick as fruit, the tomatoes or apples.
And you get paid by the weight of it, and that first half an hour, you don't have enough to balance the scale.
Because it's so light.
It's so light.
Did you imagine that you'd be doing that the rest of your life?
I couldn't see beyond that because actually it wasn't no high school for us to get an education or nothing like that. They sent you to grade school and they didn't want you to learn anything more because they figured you'd figure out how to get away from there, which we did anyway. But there wasn't no high school there. But I finished the grade school and my oldest sister was living in Baton Rouge and I moved there to try and go to high school. And as soon as I got there, my mother taking a stroke and I had to go back out there. I'm the oldest boy. And when you're the oldest boy on a plantation, you become a man before you get that age. You know, you was a man. I was a man at 12 and 13.
Where did you hear your first music?
In the gospel church, but it wasn't no instrument. Every Sunday, my mother and I would sing with the voices. And I don't know if you remember, but the early days, the gospel singers, Lou Rawls, the original Five Blind Boys.
They all sang a cappella.
Mahila. Yeah, and the voices was the instruments.
Well, actually, there was a difference. If you were Church of God in Christ, you had instruments. But if you were Baptist, you sang without instruments. And then eventually everybody started. But there were a lot of great guitarists in gospel music. Sullivan Pugh, did you know him?
Yeah, but that was later on. Uh-huh. In the beginning, I'm 76 years old. At the beginning, the gospel singers would come through the South and sing at the churches, maybe finally in Baton Rouge at the little auditorium they had at the high school, and you paid 25 cents or 35 cents to see them. That's before the B.B. Kings and everybody else introduced it, and Les Paul introduced the amplified guitar. Mm-hmm. But it was the voices was making the chords the guitar makes now with the original Five Blind Boys, a guy named Archie.
Archie Brownlee.
I don't have to tell you. You can tell me. It's very seldom you run into people who can go that far back and find it. David, who wrote the book, he's pretty good at that, too.
Now, that means you weren't listening to the radio? You didn't have a record
player?
We
didn't. I didn't know what running water was until I was 17 years old. We didn't have electricity. The first radio I heard was what you call the shotgun houses in the South, and you would take an antenna and run it from one end of the house to the other one, and if it was cloudy or raining, you couldn't hear it nowhere. It was all static. So the only way you could hear that radio was a very clear day with not a spot of cloud in the sky. Then you could hear a voice, mostly news or something like that, or maybe a Lightning Hopkins.
And then you also, the first guitarist was a friend of your parents named Coot.
Yeah.
Did he teach you how to play?
No, but I watched him, and that's only on Christmas. He didn't. You know, my parent and all out on that plantation, you didn't have but two holidays out of a year. I didn't know what Labor Day or 4th of July was. They would go get him every Christmas. And we was also poor on Christmas. We'd have, my dad mama would have a gallon of wine and a case of beer. And you and your family would come there to my house, dad's house on Christmas morning, drank that up. Then go to your house, drink that up, and then go to the next person's house, which it took you 6 hours almost to walk to the house. That's just how far their farmhouses apart. And when it was all over, this guy's name was Henry Smith, but we call him Coot for a short. Everybody's drunk, and the other kids had the little toy or something to play with. I would go get that guitar. But before the guitar, I would take rubber bands and put it up to my ear, and then I would strip the screen out of screen window and try to tighten it across the walls and put a nail in. As long as I heard something, I was into that.
So you're making a little your own guitars, in effect.
Their own noise. I was making my own noise.
Now, why do you think you were so driven to play?
I asked my grandparents that.
Because you weren't. You didn't grow up around music.
Well, it was no music. We didn't have radios and the first phonograph my daddy got, I think I was 15 or 16, or maybe 17, because that's when they finally brought the one-string electric bulb down in the center of the house.
And so you had one electric bulb. That was all you had in the house.
Yeah, and then you could plug the, he finally found a phonograph when we got big enough to pick enough cotton for him to pay that for it. And if I'm not mistaken, I don't think that thing cost $12. I think it was around $7 to get the phonograph.
And then your father bought you a guitar.
From that guy, he had one or two, and he bought me the one with the two strings on it.
He had two strings.
Yes. Yeah.
But how much music could you get out of two strings?
Well, you know, I didn't. I know he would play, and if I felt like I could fool with those two strings, and I must admit, I tell young people now who want to learn how to play, before you go pay a teacher to teach you how to play, you should let your right hand know what your left hand doing. Then if you go to the teacher, he going to charge you long and keep you long. It's like the medication I'm on a high blood pressure medicine. I do believe they got a pill that will, I don't have to take every day, but they ain't going to give it to you because they won't be making this money every month off of me like that. But anyway, when your right hand know what your left hand do, it's easy for somebody to show you what to do then, because you don't have to look at your left hand and look at your right hand and say, okay, this is the string I want both fingers on. So
yeah, we had to learn independence, actually.
Well, that's what I was doing. I was trying to figure, because I had saw him. He could play the Lonnie Johnson and Arthur Crudup stuff. And I'm like saying, hang on, my fingers ain't ever be able to move and find them spots like that. But I got to figure out that he's not looking at it both hands, but it's every time he hit this one string, that other finger was already on it. And that's what I had in my mind to learn how to do before I figured out how could I play it.
So were those the first guitarists you heard on record, Lonnie Johnson, Big Boy, Arthur Crudup, or?
I would say so, because a distant person, which out there where I was born, everybody, my grandmother would say everybody's related, which she could be right if you listen to the biblical thing, because it wasn't but two people in the beginning, Adam and Eve. And a guy bought one of the old phonograph you crank up. And on Christmas, once we'd go by that house, and he would play the Arthur Crudup and I think it was Lightning Hopkins or somebody like that. And I would hear that. And at my age at that time, I said, what is that? You know, but whatever it was sticking to me like, he couldn't look up and see an Eric Clapton or B.B. King or somebody now say making a living out of it. It was just a love of music. And we talk about it now even before Muddy Waters passed away. We learn how to play for the love of music. Nowadays, a young person can learn how to play for the love of money.
My guest is Buddy Guy, who's written with the help of David Ritz, When I Left Home, My Story. It's published by DeCapo. Your first real guitar was bought for you by a man named Mitchell Young.
Yes.
Why did he do that for you?
I guess it was a blessing. I was in Baton Rouge just before my mother taken a stroke, and I had the two string, and I would sit out there on the porch every evening and bang away with it, and this guy come walking by one evening and say, "Son, I've been noticing you. You sit there and play that guitar. I bet if you had a guitar, you'd learn how to play." And I looked at him, I said, "Yeah," because, you know, strangers down there wasn't like strangers in big cities. You know, they'd make you go down there now, they'll make you speak if you walk by that house. And he said, "What are you doing?" I think it was a Friday or Saturday evening. I said, "I'll be sitting here every evening." He came by that Friday or Saturday and took me downtown and bought me my six-string harmony. And we came back, and my sister got off work and came in and said, "Look at here, a country boy with a guitar and a guy with a quart of beer." I said, "Give me a glass and give me a quart of that beer." And he pulled a glass full, and she said, he had old Raggedy Chrysler, say, "Let's go out in the country where my dad and mom at, and you got a new guitar." And I couldn't play a finger nothing on the guitar. I was just making noise. And got to my dad's house, and this guy walked in, and my dad, as soon as he seen him, he said, "Ain't you Mitchell?" "Yeah." "We grew up together." Small world.
So how long after that did you really learn how to play guitar?
Well, I had a guy there by the name of the first electric guitar I saw. I had come out there in the country. What it was Lightning Slim, which made records for Excello Record out of Crowley, Louisiana. And he was living in Baton Rouge. So I actually got the teacher. He still lived there. While at school, I was trying to go, and my mother had the stroke. And the music teacher named Bob Johnson, he's still living. And to make you laugh a little bit, I went to him. I said, "I got to take guitar lessons." He said, "Yeah, I can teach you guitar lessons, but you got to go out and get book one." And I had this 78 by Muddy. I said, "I think I got book one." And I showed him this 78. He said, "I can't teach you that." And I said, "Well, you can't teach me then." And he laughed every time I go to Baton
Rouge. So you learn by listening to records.
Yes. Finally listening to records. And then my sister had a little radio in Baton Rouge because she had the electric lights. And then they had a record company in Tennessee, Randy Record Shop. And they would come on every night around 9. It would switch from Gallatin, Tennessee to different parts of Tennessee. And the Chess had these packaged goods with Muddy, Smokey Hawk, and the Wolf and Little Walter in them. And I think the 78 was around 60 cents or 49 cents or something like that. And you would order it from there, and it would come in the mail order. Even though some of the 78s would be cracked, you would send back, they would send you another one. And then you had to buy the needle for the old record players. And I told some people lately, with the needle get bad, you know, you couldn't play it because
it was a steel needle. You used to screw it in.
Yeah. But I found out you could take the straw out of the broom and put it in your teeth and spin the record, and you could hear it just like you can the Strat guitar now if you put your ear down on it.
Wow. So yeah. You were really being very industrious. You got a gig with a blues harp player named Big Papa, and he fired you almost right away.
I was pumping gas, my day job, and a friend of mine told him I could play the Jimmy Reed stuff, and Jimmy was coming out with hit records then.
Big Boss Man.
You Don't Have to Go. That was his first big one. And he came to the service station, and I'm like me sitting here talking to you now, because I was too shy to even hold a conversation. But I would play for one person if you were coming. I wasn't shy of that. And he came to the service station and plugged me up, and I played a couple of Jimmy's songs, and he asked me how much was I making at the station. And I think I was making about $11 or $12 a week. And he said, "I think I can give you 20 if you come play twos." I think it was twos, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And it maybe wasn't 20, but it was a little more than I was making. And I said, "Okay." And I went there that night. And I sang Hank Ballard's tune, "Work With Manny." But I was using the guitar as the group was singing, "Ooh, ooh." And I was just playing ooh, that on the guitar. Me. Yeah, ooh,
Manny,
yeah, you know them all. And, yeah. And when I got to the club that night, it must have been 20, 25 people. And I said, "I can't sing to that audience." I was too shy. And I said, "Give me the microphone." I turned my back to the audience. He said, "You got to turn around." I said, "Not tonight."
But later you became well known as a showman. In fact, you You became famous for beginning your sets off stage, walking into the club while you were playing.
That come from the late Guitar Slim. I saw him do that. But back to that other thing, what turned me around, I had a friend passed on some 10 years ago. He showed me, he said, I know how to make you turn around. He gave me a shot glass of wine, and I've been turned around ever since.
Now, you play a Fender Stratocaster. It became your signature guitar. I guess that's also from Guitar Slim.
Guitar Slim.
But isn't it more common for blues players to use guitars that have a richer, thicker tone? Isn't the Strat somewhat known as a thin-sounding guitar?
I didn't even think about that because I didn't ever think I was good enough to be here talking to you today, not only being asked to play on a Muddy Waters record, a Howlin' Wolf. And then I wasn't making records. I was mostly making records behind Coco Taylor, Junior Wells, Muddy Water. I could go on Sonny Boy and them. And the British guys was picking out the little licks I was playing unknown to me. And it was a Strat. So I went to England February 1965 before Eric got famous, before Jeff Beck and all of them. And they slept in a van. They told me this lady said they want to see me. And they saw me playing a Strat. And they said, oh, I didn't know a Strat could play blues. And they become my friends. And they told me this. And they all been a Strat ever since, you know, because they say, I thought a Strat was just for country and Western music. But I didn't, you know, I wasn't creating anything. I was just copying the T-Bones, the Lightnings, and the Muddies, and the BBs.
Well, and you were passing on, you were learning from the people before you and then passing it on to the next generation.
Well, what I was doing, I tell people, the best way I could explain that to you, I was looking for a dime on the floor and found a quarter. That's the best way I can say that, because I never could find those licks by not reading music, could figure out what it's doing. I was trying to find it through ear, which I play by ear now. And on my way trying to find this particular lick while Muddy Water was singing, I'm going back down to Louisiana to get me a mojo hand. I couldn't find that, but evidently I was finding something else for them to come and say, I got this lick from you, because every time I talk to Eric, I say, man, that record you made by Strange Brew, man, that just blew my mind. He said, sure, them your licks.
Now, you're talking about all these records you made. You made them in Chicago, so you left the South. Was that a difficult thing for you to do?
Yes, because I was the only, it's five children, and my mother had a stroke, and I knew she was going to have a fit, because she worried about not only her children, her brothers, her husband, and everybody else. And I said, it's going to worry her to death when I leave, but I must go. And they always, even before she got sick, after she was sick, they wanted us to go out on your own and try your own. Don't let me tell you what to do, because you can't come back and say, if it wasn't for me, you wouldn't have did that.
Now, so you go to Chicago, and yes, you go to Chess Records, because that's where all the great blues records are coming out of Chicago. Leonard, you go up to Leonard Chess, and you say, I play guitar and sing, and there must have been thousands of people who came up to him.
Well, first of all, you couldn't get to him. I had the letter from the disc jockey, which they would go around and pay the disc jockey to play back in those days, and they would say, I'm going to break this record for you because I'm going to play it five times on this disc jockey on my hour and a half I got. And he gave me a letter saying, give this letter to Leonard, and here's a demo tape, you give it to him. And I walked in the studio, the great guitar player named Wayne Bennett, and it was a doo-wop group called the Spaniards. They was recording them, and Wayne Bennett saw my Les Paul and fell in love with it, and they came taking my guitar and put it in a room like this and let him make the session. I'm sitting out there. I never did see Leonard. But I don't know if he listened to the tape or not.
But you wound up on those records.
I beg your pardon?
But you did wind up recording with Muddy Waters and Little Walter.
But that was later on. I went to Cobra Records first with Otis Rush and Magic Sam Habarach and Bette Everett, and I did 245 for Cobra, then it collapsed, and that's when Chess come back and got me and Otis to sign up.
Just one more thing. Pretty much everybody who plays the blues these days or accompanies people like you is white. You don't see young black players being interested in that music anymore. They're listening to other things. Why do you think that is?
I think if I didn't hear it the way I heard it, I don't know if I would have been like that, because their old AM stations played Count Basie, Woody Herman, Mahalia Jackson, Lightning Hopkins. And then they played spiritual. Nowadays, the average black kid, my kids, didn't know who I was until they turned 21 and they walked in, and all of them cried and said, "Dad, I didn't know you could do that."
And the book, wish we could have gotten to more of the story, but it's been such a great honor talking with you. Buddy Guy, When I Left Home, My Story, written with the help of David Ritz, published by DiCapo. Let's listen to him singing Going Home.
Thank you so much, sir. Thank you for having me. When I get my load.